Friends, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Welcome to the show. I'm glad you're part of what we do here. And I trust on a regular basis. I actually have people that tell me they've been listening for a long, long time. Some say, I've been listening for 35 years. Of course, I've only been on the air for 30 years. And I don't correct them, though, because they're complimenting me. And whenever, here's my basic rule about that kind of thing. And that is when and anybody wants to give me a compliment, I get out of the way. I let them talk. So they're saying nice things about me, and it seems like I've been on the air forever and to them, and sometimes it seems that way for me. But only 30 years now, and all-time productively used, as far as I'm concerned. In other words, I'm glad to have been able to invest my time in this enterprise for that long. A lot of people don't get an opportunity like this. It's not because I love radio either, and this is catches some people by surprise. To me, it's a stewardship. I wasn't trained to do this, and when I started, I was a total greenhorn. Somebody said, "Here's the mic, go," and off I went, and I stumble around for a bit. But what I did do is I listened to other people who I thought were really good in the medium. They managed the medium well and in a professional way, and I just simply tried to mimic them, which incidentally is a good way of learning something. And whether it's teaching or speaking or radio or some kind of sport, there you look at someone who does it well and you kind of get a mental image. Sometimes in sports, you got a picture. You see somebody executing forehands in tennis, for example. I played competitive tennis for many years, and sometimes my best games were the afternoon after I had watched a championship tennis game on TV. Somehow I just internalized some of these things, and I just could execute them more effectively on the court. Well, this applies to other areas of life, too, and this is part of the point of mentorship. This is why I want people to listen to this show after I've taught them about, say, the tactical approach, or I've taught them something about clear thinking. Those are teachings somewhat in the abstract, and some things are caught better than they're taught. So I can lay this out in the principled fashion, and then I want them to listen to the show so they can see these concepts in action, okay? And that's a huge part of mentoring, and it's a role that I take on behalf of you, the listeners, and other people participating in my life gladly. Because the virtuous things, and there are some of those in my life, I want to have showcased for the purpose of others seeing them and making them part of their life. And the virtues, such as they are in my own life, are there because of the exact same thing, having other people like my first mentor, Craig Englert, or subsequent mentors like J.P. Moreland, having those people live those moral and intellectual and relational virtues out in my presence, as it were. And as I walked with them through the process, I caught many things that couldn't be taught. And though many of you, obviously, the vast majority of you cannot share in a personal interactive relationship with me, still, even though this is unidirectional from me to you, I hope that my manner and my content and my way has a salutary effect on you so that you can then pay that forward in other people's lives. Having been on radio 30 years, obviously I've had lots of interesting conversations and some stand out. And I want to talk a little bit about a concept that I developed that's started out as a conversation with a caller. And for those of you who are still on board from the KBRT days, my flagship station when I started in the 90s, early 90s, 1993, with radio, you might remember somebody who would call in on a regular basis, and his name was Doug, and he identified himself as an atheist, but he was somewhat of a reluctant atheist. And so we called him Doug the Reluctant Atheist, you know, and he'd call in and he, at least the nature of the conversation, well, I mean, I like to believe what you believe, but I'm a little uncertain about these things. And so maybe you can help me out. And I think he was entirely genuine about this, as far as I could tell. He wasn't putting on anything. But so I'd answer some questions. Then a couple weeks or a month or so later, he'd call in. Hi, this is Doug. Oh, the Reluctant Atheist. Yeah, that's me. Let's talk. And so we had a number of conversations. And one day, Doug called in and said to me on the air, he said, I'm not an atheist anymore. He said, I'm an agnostic. So I said, good, that's progress. So now you're Doug, the Reluctant Agnostic. Great. And we moved from there. But at this point, though, I realized he was moving forward a bit. He wasn't convinced of atheism, but now he's not convinced of either atheism or theism. He's kind of in the middle. He's an agnostic. And by the way, there are two types of agnostics. If anyone tells you, well, I'm an agnostic, you know what that means. They don't know. Agnosko, not knowing. Could be this, could be that. All right. There are two types of those agnostics. One is an agnostic says, I don't know, and I'm open to the options of finding out. Another one is an agnostic who says, I don't know, and nobody knows, because the answer to this is unknowable. That's a strong agnostic in the sense that they are basically immovable. They don't know, and you don't know, and nobody knows, because this is unknowable. That's a whole different kind of problem. But Doug was like the first. He was movable. He was open. He was thinking this is a possible enterprise. And so, I mean, it might be possible to know these things. And so we would have our conversations. But at this point in the conversation, I thought to myself, how am I going to deal with Doug? You know, I've talked about a lot of details, et cetera, et cetera. And it just suddenly occurred to me that I have a suspicion that Doug actually agrees with me on many details of my worldview as a Christian. Now, this comment betrays a kind of a deeper conviction that I have about these things that wasn't, that I didn't refine for myself even until much later, till years and years later. And many of you have heard the story of me talking with my eldest daughter, Annabeth, when she was about 8 years old, and she asked, why do we believe God is true? Or how do we know God is true, is the way she put it. And even though she believed in God and was embracing Christianity at that time, still, she wanted to know the reasons why. And I thought about it for a moment, and then I said, this idea came into my mind, And I said this statement, which I realize now really captures my whole approach to the entire enterprise of making the case for Christianity, and it captures it in a single sentence. And I said, honey, the reason that we believe that God is true is because he's the best explanation for the way things are. The reason that we believe God is true is because he's the best explanation of the way things are. And so my statement broadly put here, and I didn't put it this way to my 8-year-old, but it has to do with the explanatory power of the Christian worldview. Now, I want you to think for just a moment about what a worldview is. A worldview is a take or an understanding of the way the world is. And it includes particulars about the way the world is, and it includes a kind of explanatory scheme about the way the world is, all right? So here's what we see in the world, and here is a way of viewing it that makes sense of what we see. Okay. Now, all worldviews have loose ends. There's a lot of outliers for every worldview. That is, there is no worldview that doesn't have some questions that are unanswered, or there are some dangling parts that you can't neatly tuck in. And I don't think that's because all worldviews are flawed necessarily, because I think you can have a worldview that's accurate. What it means is that life is messy and knowing is messy. And especially when you're dealing with a personal God as a central part of your worldview, there are things that God chooses to do or directions he decides to go that he doesn't inform us the rationale for. So we would ask the question, why did God do this, or why didn't he do that? And those are questions that largely cannot be answered because God hasn't told us that. So I'm just looking at a broad foundation here. I'll get back to Doug in just a moment. That what a worldview is meant to do is kind of capture as best as possible the way the world is and the reason why the world is that way. Okay, so a materialist will say, well, the world is just made of matter and there's no direction to it. It's no purpose to it. And maybe they can't discern a purpose. And so then they deny the existence of God, and therefore what we have as moral motions, the moral activity that we engage in, isn't a result of responding to divine commands, but it's something that evolution has taught us to do. So notice that in this particular example, there's an attempt to observe some things about the world, and like moral motions, for example, and then understand those in light of the broad explanatory system that one has. If your explanatory system is materialism, only the material world exists, it's physical, and it responds by natural law, and that's it. Nobody's up there pushing and pulling things around for broader, grander purposes, well, then morality turns out to be an illusion. I mean, there's an entailment relationship. All right. There are certain things that follow naturally from a worldview explanatory system. Okay. And there are all kinds of them out there. All the religions are pictures of reality that they deem to be accurate characterizations. And they all have, on some measure, explanatory power. They would say, this is our view, and that explains why you see this detail in the world. Okay, and when I use the word world, I don't mean just in the physical world or in the universe. I mean in everything that is. Now, some worldviews restrict everything it is to the physical world. That's materialism, but I'm just using the word in a broader sense. Okay, so when it comes to the Christian worldview, my conviction is that there are quite a number of things that we are intimately aware of as being features of the real world. And when it comes to a kind of a common sense assessment or acknowledgement of that, an even-handed seeing of particulars in the world, then it turns out that Christianity does the best job of explaining those particulars. Here's how they fit into our world. For example, people raise the issue of the problem of evil, and understandably, because everyone knows something's wrong with the world. Everybody. It doesn't matter when you lived or where you lived. We all know this, which is why the issue comes up more so frequently. And some fancy this in some measure, and I understand the reaction or the response even, that this is somehow evidence against theism in general, and certainly against Christianity. But one point that I want to make is this world, the way we experience it, is exactly the way we'd expect it to be if Christianity were true. Really? With all the evil? Yes, of course, because our whole story is about the problem of evil and how it gets solved. Without the problem of evil, we have no story, okay? The problem starts in chapter 3 of our story, doesn't get resolved until 66 books later. That's a long read. That's a long story. Right. It's thousands of years of history, thousands and thousands and thousands. How many thousands? I don't know, but it's a long time. And so without the problem of evil, we'd have no story. It's not a conflict to our story. It is our story, the problem and the solution. So I use that just as an example of how there is an observation about reality that anyone can make without any, in a certain sense, robust theological presuppositions. Hey, this is the way the world is. What best explains this detail that we all seem to discover in the world? That's the kind of question that I'm asking. And by the way, the more times one's explanation of the way the world is fits up with the way the world is, that is the classic definition of truth. If you, Aristotle said, if you say a thing is and it is, or you say a thing isn't and it isn't, well, that's what truth means. Now, if you say a thing isn't and it is, or it is and it isn't, then that's false. Pretty straightforward. Now, you're thinking, man, Aristotle said that? I could have said that. That's easy. You're right. It's the common sense understanding of what we mean when we say something is true or false. So if you're trying to find the accurate worldview, you're going to try to find connecting points between what the worldview states is so and what the world actually is like. And the more times you see those connectors, the stronger the case is that your worldview taken as a whole is true. And the fewer times there are connectors, or if there are counterintuitive beliefs, that is, statements that seems completely opposite of the way the world is as we experience it, especially if these are weighty matters, like on the issue of morality, wow, then that seems to be evidence that the world, that view is false. Even though there might be some things that seem to make sense, taken as a whole, at the foundation, it looks more and more like that worldview is false. And so there's a little primer there about how to understand the way worldviews work and how we assess which worldview is accurate. Okay, now let's go back to our friend Doug, the reluctant agnostic at this point. Because I'm a little, I wasn't bugged at him, but I was a little intellectually frustrated because I'm trying to think, what more can I say to Doug? You know, we've had lots of conversations and there's a little progress here, but I don't know where to go. And as I'm talking with him and pausing mentally, I realize, here's what occurred to me. I thought, you know, Doug, and I said this, I bet you there's more that you and I agree on than you think, that we actually agree on. And it turns out that those things that we agree on fit nicely into a Christian worldview, but do not in an atheist worldview. And so if he's on the fence and I can show him, well, you agree with this, right? Well, yeah, that makes sense. Or you agree with this. Yeah, okay. You agree with this? Yeah. Well, all of that is at home in our worldview, but it's not at home in an atheist and I'm atheistic worldview, and I'm looking to kind of tilt him more towards the truth. All right? The truth. That is the worldview that fits the world as it actually is. And so I started mentioning a few things here, you know, and, you know, he'd give the nod as I explained him a little bit. And then we'd move forward. Now, that became a kind of a strategy for me to make the case for Christianity. And there are a number of times where I went in a university setting into philosophy classrooms, and I made the case for Christianity in this way. And I'm going to outline that for you in just a moment, the things that I offered. But basically, my point of view was, you students in the classroom who are not Christians and maybe atheists or skeptics or whatever, you know, and this is largely the case in a secular college or university philosophy class. And in this particular case, the professor who had me come into his class a number of times to do this term after term, as a representative of Christianity, the professor himself was an atheist. Okay, great. So I have a large, what do they call it? A large target audience or something like that. Or the, is that, that's not the right term. I had a lot of targets. What is it? Amy's trying to tell me. No, it's not a captive audience. That's not what I'm looking for. It's just when you go in and you've got a lot of targets, okay, that, oh, the target-rich environment, maybe something like that. All right, target-rich environment. Makes it sound like I'm going to gun them down. But anyway, it was a target-rich environment. Okay, a lot of people disagreed with me, but here's what I'm telling you. I think you probably agree with me more than you realize. Now, keep in mind here that I have something else going for me, and I talk about this in a lot more detail in a Solid Ground I wrote that ended up in the 10th anniversary edition of Tactics, in a chapter devoted to a maneuver that I call Inside Out. Now, the notion of Inside Out is that if Christianity is true, then human beings are all made the image of God and they have to live in the world that God has made. That's the real world. There's an external world that is the way it is, the way God made it, and there's an internal world for every human being that is the way God made it to be. Human beings are made in the image of God. Now, if that's the case, then there are going to be obvious things when you think about it that are in the world that fit that, and there are going to be things inside of us that bear testimony to that, even when we say we disagree. Okay, so just as kind of an example, very quickly, somebody says there is no objective morality. It's all relative. In other words, there are no rules that apply to everybody necessarily. Okay, it's everybody makes up their own thing. So I get it. They say that. The next sentence, therefore, it's wrong for you to push your morality on me. Now, do you see the contradiction there? If the first statement is true, then the second statement has got to be false. If there is no objective morality, it can't be wrong for us to push our morality on someone else because that's a statement of objective morality. Okay? So why are they saying opposing things in two sentences connected to each other? Because on the one hand, they're voicing their personal philosophy, and on the other hand, they're stating something that they are convinced of deep down inside, and they can't escape even when they try to. And that is that the world is thick with morality, and we as human beings are capable of knowing it. And now sometimes we make mistakes, but what wasn't a mistake in that statement was the second statement, that there is a legitimacy to moral judgments. It's wrong for you to do this to me. Because there are things that are wrong that we do to other people. Now, if you're a relativist, you can't say that. All you can say is, I don't like it. I'm just using that as an example where there is a kind of a bold statement on the outside, but when the person isn't thinking and kind of protecting philosophical turf, it just comes out. It just comes out. Okay, the opposite, the truth comes out, okay? And this, as I explain in the Tactics book in the chapter on Inside Out, that which is built in on the inside always comes out on the outside. All we have to do is listen for it. And so that is kind of the approach behind this way of offering the truthfulness or the legitimacy of Christianity. Even though this Inside Out Tactic chapter is new, it just came out in the revised edition of Tactics, which, by the way, if you got the first one and liked it, you ought to get the second one because there's like 45% additional material, new material. It's like 45% larger. It's got like six extra chapters. It's got three, you know, blah, 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 blah. Okay, you got to get it. And by the way, I just checked the other day. I have 127 reviews on Amazon, and every single one of them is a 5-star review except for one, and that's a 4-star review with no comment. So I don't even know why they dropped a star, but some troll. But I can hardly complain, all right? So almost a virtual perfect 5 is pretty good. I'm glad for that. I'm not trying to wave my own flag. I'm just saying this is the way people are responding to this book. If you haven't got it, I recommend you grab it. Even if you got the first one, take the first one, give it away. Get the new one. It's vastly improved. I know it's hard to imagine after the first one. How could he improve on that? But yeah. But it has a chapter on the Inside Out Tactic, and that's what kind of is in play here. I was aware of this notion before I articulated it in specific intentional form in that chapter, and here it's at play. And so here is the way I approach the class. I would say to the class, I know we have different points of view. We're standing on different squares, basically. We have different assessments about the nature of the world. Okay, fair enough. However, I have a feeling that most of the things that are central to my worldview are things that you would acknowledge to be so, especially if you have an initial impulse to deny it. If I talked to you a little bit and listened to the way that you talked about the world, I could show you that actually deep down inside you really believe this. And if it turns out that the convictions that you have largely match up with mine when we're really honest about it, that is the particulars, the details of the nature of the world, then a worldview like mine, which has explanatory power for those details, may be worth your consideration. And I'm going to give you a list of what those things are and explain them a little bit, because I think they're powerful. And I find that I use different aspects of this all the time. But I will tell you the upshot, in case I don't want to forget it, that is the response I got from the students. I had students during the Q&A after I made my presentation, and I wrote things down on the board, and I just put all these points up there. You know, I'm carrying on in the classroom like a, you know, professor, teacher, whatever, and I'm having a good time. And then I do Q&A at the end. And these students have had different folks that have come in and made their presentation to the group from different points of view. And in some cases, there were Christians that came in that were preaching at them is what it amounted to, and then got them all riled up. They had big battles, and that's what they're expecting with me. Oh, another Christian guy is going to tell us all this stuff. He's right. We're wrong. And bang, 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 and no, we're going to fight with him. Okay, looking forward to that. But at the end of my talk, I had a student raise his hand. You know, there's not many people that are looking for questions. And again, he raises his hand. He said, well, you know what? I don't know what I can disagree with based on what you said. I thought we were going to have a big fight here, you know, like we've had with some other Christians that come in, but I can't disagree with the particulars that you offered. Now, he didn't become a Christian at that moment. I mean, that was a huge stone in his shoe, I think. And I don't know what eventually happened with them, but that was... to me, that was I was gratified for that remark because it showed that the things that I've been saying had found a place. Something was taking root. I got him thinking. And those of you who know about the tactical game plan know that that's all I'm after. I'm not trying to lead a bunch of people to Christ. I'm not trying to harvest. I'm trying to garden. And so I'm going to put things out there to get them thinking. If I can put a stone in their shoe, if I can annoy them in a good way, if I can get them thinking about Christ or Christianity or theism, fine. Now, I know some of you say, well, theism, that doesn't get anybody saved. They just believe in God. Right. First things first. Theism is not adequate. Nobody says it's adequate. It's necessary, but not sufficient. No, it's not sufficient, but it is necessary. So we can get that far with somebody, we're moving forward. Okay, that's a stone in the shoe. We're moving ahead. So what are the kinds of things that I told them that I thought that they believed that I believe? Okay, and let me just suggest a couple of things. So here's the first thing I told the students. And remember, this is an outgrowth of this conversation with Doug, the reluctant agnostic. I said, we both believe in science. Well, yeah. Well, what's controversial about that? Well, you have to think about the preconditions that make science possible, okay? There would have to be a material world that exists. And incidentally, though that may sound completely unprofound to most people, the fact is that the core idea of Vedantic Hinduism is that the physical world does not exist. That the only thing that exists is one thing, and that one thing is an impersonal God. That's why it's called monism, one-ism. And that all that we think is the material world is actually an illusion. It's called Maya. And the illusion keeps us, which are also part of an illusion, thinking we are separate from the one true God, which is impersonal. And so we go through cycles of reincarnation, working off our karma, so we can finally be lost like a drop of water going into the ocean, into the divine nature. Okay, something that's an oversimplification. You get my point. What at the core of this, though, is a denial that not only that the material world exists, but a denial that there's any kind of meaningful distinctions between anything, which includes right and wrong. All right. So when I say we believe in science, and that sounds uncontroversial, it actually, when you think of worldviews, this eliminates some worldviews because it affirms that the material world exists. And that it is orderly, right? If it's not orderly, you can't do science. And can be experienced and measured with reasonable accuracy. In order to experience it and measure it with reasonable accuracy, there have to be some other things that are true about human beings. That is, they have to have cognitive faculties that can be trusted. Now, a very compelling argument can be made and has been made by notables like Alvin Plantinga, that if the Darwinian project is sound, then you can't trust your mind's or your brain's capability of assessing things and coming to the conclusion that evolution is true, because evolution does not choose for truth. It chooses for survivability. Okay. So notice here, just by acknowledging that science works, oh yeah, we all agree with that, but it works for certain reasons, certain things have to be in place. Now you're into very deep and profound worldview considerations. Well, wait a minute. If there is no organizing principle, personal organizing principle in the universe, and everything's by accident, how can we trust our knowledge that we gain by assessing the world in a particular way? So I believe in science, but I think the reason that science works is because there is a material world, it's not an illusion, and that human beings have rational, reasonable minds that were made rational and reasonable by another rational and reasonable individual so that we could accurately, with our senses and our reasonable assessments, measure the world that actually is. So what this means is, though we both believe in science, those who are not theists have to make commitments to concepts that make sense in theistic worldview that make no sense in an atheistic worldview. And therefore, then, the thing that we both agree on makes more sense in our worldview than theirs. And so that's a plus for us. That's my point. All right. So there's one, that the universe was not only made, but it was made for a purpose. Okay. And so, and not only the universe, the human beings. We are teleological by nature. That is, we act for certain ends. We are trying to accomplish things. We are going somewhere with our actions, all right? Now, I think animals do that too, to some degree, not in a very sophisticated ways, but, I mean, our cat looks over at the food in the corner and walks towards it and eats. It's hungry. It decides to move towards the food for the reason of arriving there and satisfying its appetite. Pretty straightforward, pretty simple. But there's more that's going on, because human beings seem to be aware that our lives are not just for satisfying our appetites. Our lives are for something more, which is why, by the way, people ask, what is the meaning of life? Why would anybody ask that question unless it was meaningful? Now, some might say, well, there's no meaning to life, but notice that the impulse to ask the question indicates that they have a native sense that lives have purposes. And I'll show you a very good example about how this can be revealed in people who deny it. I asked them, would you ever talk somebody out of a suicide? Now, I mean, generally, most people are going to say yes, of course, especially if you're not in a philosophic conversation about the existence of God and the meaning of life. So if they're not consciously trying to defend turf, they're going to say, of course I'm going to try to talk someone out of suicide. When I leave LAX, the many times I do a month, and I'm going out there or towards the baggage, there's a thing there, there's a big sign about talking people out of suicide, especially young people, because it's such a problem with them now. So of course, yeah, they'll talk. Here's my question. Why? Why would you do that? And I'm waiting for them to answer. You know what their answer is? More or less, it fits in this general category because I don't want them to waste their lives. I don't want them to do something stupid. Why is it stupid to kill yourself? Because there's so much to live for. Okay, maybe. Notice that the impulse to want to talk somebody out of a suicide is based on the idea that something that has meaning and purpose in itself will be cut short. You won't, you die an untimely death or before your time. Why do people say that? Because there's this internal sense that we are made for something more than just satisfying our carnal, fleshly appetites. There's some nobler purpose. Now, atheists will say, in denying that there is some transcendent meaning to life, they'll say, no, well, our meaning is the meaning we make for ourselves. That's kind of the existentialist response. We decide what's meaningful for us. Okay, I get that. But in this case, the person who wants to commit suicide is saying what's meaningful for them is to kill themselves. So by what rationale, even on the existentialist kind of way of looking at it, the atheistic existentialist way, what is your rationale for interfering? And I think the reason they're interfering is something else is going on inside them that's deep and profound. And it's an acknowledgement that there is more to life than molecules clashing in the universe. There is something true we know about the world, now writ large, that cannot be captured in the truncated nothingism worldview of atheism or materialism. And by the way, when I say nothingism, this is not an ad hominem. This is a description. There is nothing there. There's no morality. There's no meaning. There's no purpose. There's no direction. Things just are. And this is why it's not surprising when philosophical existentialists examining the circumstances adopt nihilism, which is nothingism, and commit suicide. All right? It follows naturally from their worldview. Now, when they do this, we do think it tragic. Why? Because we know better. So here on this point, we believe in science and then the preconditions that are necessary for science to work. And we also believe that human lives have transcendent purpose, not just the purpose that we assign to it, but something higher that we should be shooting for. That's why we talk about the high moral ground. That's why when people say, well, that's ignorant, what's wrong with that? Well, we should be better informed. Why should we? Well, we're rational creatures. Yeah, but that's true. Well, that means we ought to use our reason to understand the truth of the universe. Notice all the teleology, all the purposefulness in those comments. This betrays their understanding of the nature of the world as being consistent with our assessment, not their assessment, all right? So there's two things, science and all that is entails and purpose and meaning in the universe, okay? I can toss into that purpose, and we all believe the universe was designed for a purpose. It's the design part I'm focusing on right now. How do we know? No, it isn't. This is evolution. This is time and chance. No, what, really? Okay. When people look and contemplate the splendor and the grandeur of nature, to whom do they attribute it? They don't attribute it to accident, not when they're reflecting, in a sense, elegantly on it. They attribute it to a person. Now, they don't attribute it to Father, obviously. That's God. They attribute it to Mother. Look at the wonders of Mother Nature, all right? Now, of course, they would say, well, that's just the way we talk about it. Sure, but why do you talk about it that way? And I think the reason is because when we look at the physical world and the way everything operates, it looks like particular physical things are made for particular purposes. It looks like there's somebody behind the curtain that's monkeying with things. And so we give the nod to Mother. not to Father. See, Mother makes no moral demands on us. Father does. So it's either easier to acknowledge Mother, Mother Nature, Mother Earth, if you will, and not Father, because we like that better. But notice the impulse to acknowledge a mind behind everything. Now, as I said, you point this out, and they're going to say, well, I don't really mean it that way. But then the question I ask is, then why is it so frequently stated that way? Do you know, I saw this unbelievable science documentary once, and maybe it's still available online. It's called Close Encounters, not the movie by Steven Spielberg. It's the, I'm looking for my notes. Close, where is that? Close Encounters of a Floral Kind, like flowers. Close Encounters of a Floral Kind, okay? And I'll tell you what was magnificent, just unbelievable about this movie. They're looking at, what's that flower that, you know, my wife loves them. They're tropical. They live in trees. They kind of, a plant that grows on another plant. You get them in, Amy, help me out. The flower that lives in jungles and on vines. No. That's a carnivorous one, not a Venus flytrap. Oh, for crying out loud. I got to call my wife right now. Yeah, everybody knows this flower. No. It's very simple. They come in like this, and they grow on the side of trees, and they kind of, they sit. They're not in the tree. It's their own thing. They're very elegant. I don't think they're that pretty, but people think of them as very special and elegant. Anyway, goodness gracious me. I'll think of it. Orchids. Thank you. High five her. Got it. Orchids. And there's 10,000 people screaming at their, you know, device right now. Orchids, you idiot! Yes, orchids. So this movie is about Close Encounters of a Floral Kind, and they're looking at orchids. Okay? Now, you know, in order for plants to reproduce, there's a pollination process. Pollen from one plant has got to be distributed in some way to another plant. Sometimes that's by wind. Sometimes it's by insects, like bees. And in this case, that's the primary way the pollen is transferred. But here's how it works. There is a little, like a pocket of something sort that the nectar is down, and the critter, like the bee, has to go down inside. This is all filmed. You can see it all happening. It goes down inside to get the nectar. But there's all these little pointy things on the inside of this bucket they go down into that keep them from going back up. It pushes at them. They can't go that way. They got to go a different way. There's an exit. Okay, and they find the exit to get out, and when they go out, I promise you, the orchid plant attaches a little packet of pollen to their butts. And then they fly off with this pollen packet on their behind, right? Oh, that's kind of like a pun. I didn't do that on purpose. Anyway, so then they go to the next pollen, then the next, what is it, orchid plant, and they go down the little thing. And they got the thing in their butt from the other plant. They drink a little more nectar, and then they go out, and that plant plucks the packet from their behind and puts it into play to make more orchids. Tell me there's no God, for goodness sake. It's an assembly line process. And the reason, of course, this was a secular station. They were just saying, like, wow, Mother Nature, cool. No, somebody, not Mother. Father. It's so obvious. Okay. So, anyways, that's another commitment that people have about the nature of the world that makes no sense in a naturalistic world, but does in a theistic world. We ought to check that out. Close Encounters of a Floral Kind. It's got to be around. This was before the internet that I saw it. It was in the 80s or something, but, yeah, we'll look it up, and you could look it up. It's probably on YouTube. Okay, so we got science and all that entails. We've got the universe designed and for a purpose. People believe that deep down inside, and they reveal it by their language. We also believe in right and wrong. We are all committed, deeply committed, to the notion of objective morality, even when we posture as relativists. And I gave you an illustration of that. There is no objective morality, therefore it's wrong for you to push yours on me. Contradictory statement. There are no objective moral rules. Here's one. see how that works. But that isn't the best illustration. The best illustration of people's deep commitment to the fact that the universe is profoundly moral, that is, it contains substantive moral categories, is the fact that that virtually everybody wonders about the problem of evil, even theistic people. All right, they wonder about the problem of evil. Why is the world so broken? Things are not the way they're supposed to be. Well, if you think about it, the only way things could be not the way they're supposed to be, problem of evil, is if there is a way they're supposed to be and they aren't that way. But there can't be a way they're supposed to be without a sposer. There's got to be someone above the whole system that purposes the world for a certain way, that it be good and moral, and it isn't that way. Now, that raises legitimate questions about how things could get so messed up if God is good and powerful. It's a separate issue. But what I'm saying is that challenge makes no sense. It is not coherent until we first acknowledge that there is evil in the world that departs from him. Universal standard of good. God has got to be in place to even answer the question. And by the way, atheists have the same problem we do, because the problem of evil is a human problem. It is not, I'm sorry, yeah, it's a human problem. It's not a Christian problem. Everybody faces it, and therefore every worldview has to explain it. Going back to Hinduism, to classic monism, pantheistic monism, they explain it by denying it, that evil and good are part of the illusion. Those distinctions don't fit ultimately in that worldview. Okay, so that's a way of explaining it. It ain't real. But we know better. I think a worldview that says it is real is more reliable than a worldview that says it's not real. Okay? And the Christian worldview says it is real. And the atheistic worldview says it's not real, even though atheists complain about it. So my question to the atheists is, how do you solve the problem of evil? Now, you've gotten rid of God. I get that. I understand why you'd be an atheist in light of the problem of evil. By the way, just pointing out that you haven't solved the problem. You haven't given us an answer. You have just eliminated a way of answering it. Now, given the resources of materialism, describe to me the traction you can get to make sense of this problem and answer it. And they can't do that. And that's why what they end up doing is say, well, it's an illusion, or it's just, you know, whatever, something evolution taught us to believe that doesn't exist, which is ironic because just a few moments ago they were talking about how real evil was, which is why they don't believe in God, and their solution is to say there is no evil. Do you see how counterintuitive that is? So the problem of evil is in itself, that people acknowledge it, is an acknowledgement that they are aware that, one, that the universe is deeply moral and it falls short of its moral requirements. So there's two things going on there. There's the external fact of morality that's being violated, and there's the internal fact of our awareness of it. We have the capacity to understand that and see it. This is what Francis Schaeffer called moral motions. We have the machinery to assess that. This isn't brain machinery, by the way. This is mind machinery, okay? So everybody believes in good and evil. This is why they complain about the problem of evil, but that makes no sense in a materialistic worldview. It makes sense in ours. There's another touch point. Incidentally, Amy did the footwork here. It's called sexual? Really? Okay. Well, that would make more sense. Sexual encounters of the floral, F-L-O-R-A-L, kind, 1981. Nicely done, Amy. So when you looked it up, is it available? I mean, is it on YouTube or something, or is it just says it? There are clips on YouTube. Well, maybe they got clips of the packet on the B-butt. That is just unbelievable. Amazing. Okay, so what I've done is I've given you now, what, four different things that everybody knows. Even when they deny that they believe it, they demonstrate they believe it in unguarded moments. I think there's a couple of other things that everybody knows, too. And I developed these notions much more thoroughly in the story of reality. And that is that everybody knows that human beings are wonderful. That in, now I know you're saying not my in-laws, you know, that's not what I mean. I mean humans as humans. There is something especially special. Can I say that? Especially special. Spatial. Not S-P-A-T-I-A-L, although that's true also. But they are spatial and spatial about human beings. This is why, for example, we can gas termites but not Jews. You don't do that to human beings. Why not? If human beings are merely highly developed animals, and that's the long and short of it, and we are meat all the way down, so to speak, why not? If it's convenient, why not? And this is something that atheists cannot answer. What they can do is give you a subjectivistic opinion. They could say, well, we don't like that. And so we have decided not to countenance things we don't like. But I'll tell you something. The leadership of the Third Reich liked it just fine. So what is the basis of our objecting if the transcendent basis for our objecting if we've acknowledged that the only thing that's wrong is wrong for us, we don't like it. If somebody else likes it, then it would be right for them, and you can't take it any further, okay? But we know better, don't we? And during the trials there, the Nuremberg War trials after the war, this was part of what was argued. You know, we were just doing what we were told to do. We were following the dictates of our culture. And the argument from the courts were there is a law above the law. There's a law over everyone. And that's why they're justified in prosecuting those war criminals based on the law above the law. And this is something we all know. And that's why we say, hey, that ain't right. They shouldn't do that. Whatever it happens to be. And maybe some of the standard moral categories aren't popular for people anymore, but there's a whole lot of politically correct ones. Global warming, secondhand smoke, sexual slavery, and on and on and on and on and on. Political figures, they're evil, man. Well, these folk mean, when they say these things, that the evil is real evil. These things are bad. They're not just things we don't like. Okay, but not only do human beings know that human beings are beautiful and special and unique in some way and participate in morality, they also know that human beings do not keep the moral code that they affirm. They are beautiful, but they are broken. They are beautiful, but they are broken. And we are not just broken the way a machine is broken that just needs to be fixed. Sometimes people talk that way. We don't just have a disease. We need to take a pill and get healed. The brokenness is a moral brokenness. We are morally broken. We have done things we shouldn't have done. The problem of evil sits on our doorstep. Our fingerprints are on the smoking gun. We are the perps. We're the perpetrators of the crimes we complain about. We are guilty. There is a moral law, and we don't keep it, and we know this. And this is why when I spoke at Berkeley a number of years ago, I could address a large audience, overfill rooms. It was great. It was before things got radically crazy the way they are lately. And I was talking about the failure of relativism and that if moral relativism failed, then some form of moral objectivism was true, that there are rules that we ought to obey. But the fact is we don't. And that's why this point of view, this discovery of objective moral rules based on the failure of relativism, has explanatory power. It explains why we feel something that we all feel at different times. We realize we don't keep the moral laws, and we have a feeling about that. And the feeling we have about not keeping the moral laws has a word to describe it. And I ask the audience, what is the word that we use to describe our own angst about the fact that we do not keep the moral laws that we profess are real? And I just waited. And then I began hearing it from the audience here, up there, over there. Guilt, guilt, guilt. Yeah, we feel guilty. And then I ask the question, why do we feel guilty? I mean, maybe society causes that or something like that. We can talk about that. But how about this? Maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. Is that in the running? And then I explained to them that the answer to guilt that we all know we have is not denial. That is relativism. The answer to guilt, I said, is forgiveness. And this, I told them, is where Jesus comes in. Now, at Cal, giving that lecture that night, it was a Friday night, I had not mentioned Jesus' name or anything really religious up until that point. But what I was doing was disking and plowing and making the field ready to get this message that now made sense, I think, to them in a different way than it would have if I had just launched out with that. And I will tell you something, that when I say that the answer to guilt is not denial but forgiveness, every single time I say that, I can feel something move inside of me. I can feel something, some hunger being satisfied, some thirst being quenched by that notion. Because this is also, as I'm saying, part of the human condition. Our own brokenness yearns to be fixed morally, and the only fix for the moral problem is forgiveness. We can't go back and undo the past. We need to be forgiven for it, and this we yearn for. And so when I say the answer to guilt is forgiveness, I know that this is a statement that is finding a place in the hearts of so many people. It's not a apologetics argument. It is an appeal to the existential state of every human being that I know is real because they're all made the image of God and they have to live in the world that God has made. And so as I go through these particular things, the belief in science and all that's entailed there, the belief in the purpose and meaning of life, the belief in the design of the universe, the belief in right and wrong, the belief that human beings are special and unique and also not only beautiful but broken and guilty and in need of salvation, all of that fits perfectly in a Christian worldview. All of those things that those students already believed, it fits perfectly in the Christian worldview, but has no place whatever in a non-Christian worldview, which means that every one of those points, the Christian worldview is confirmed and the atheist worldview is denied. Something to think about. All right, friends, thank you for spending this hour with me. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye.